All right, welcome everybody to Shiur number 2 of 3 in our series. The learning is in for the merit of Refuah Shleima of Yisrael Meir Ben Perel. So we should have him in mind as we proceed with the Shiur.
Okay. Thank you so much. Thanks for organizing and hosting this Shiur. I'm very happy to be here. The title of my Shiur, for those of us who weren't just discussing it before the recording turned on, is Vinahafachur, Averot permitted on Purim. There is a certain stigma about Purim that exists out there in the world. I remember when I was in one of the very few Jewish studies courses I took while at university, and the professor there, for one of the classes, decided he was going to explain Purim to the students. Mind you, this was not a frum professor, but, you know, someone fairly traditional. He said, Purim's a day where none of the rules apply. Everybody goes around doing anything that they can't do on any other day of the year. And it's really crazy and out of control, and that's the way it is. And I didn't really like that so much. But then I went back, and I looked through the halachos. And when you first read through the halachos that Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah tell us about Purim, in this case specifically the Ramah, you get kind of confused as to, wait, is there some element of things that we would otherwise not be allowed to do during the year that are allowed on Purim? Let's take a look at some examples first. I mean, the first one that comes to mind before we even look at any examples would be getting rip-roaring drunk. Generally, that's something that we assume Judaism frowns upon. There are plenty of stories in Tanakh to prove it. There are plenty of other reasons why drinking is not something that's looked positively upon in various Jewish sources. But yet on Purim, we're supposed to get absolutely trashed, at least according to some opinions. We will bring that up at one point in this year. But let's take a look at some other very curious laws that relate to Purim, that I call the special allowances for Purim. If we look at source number one, the Ramah tells us, at the end of Or HaChaim 695, that v'yesh omrim, some say, d'im hizik echad et chaveiro mikoach simchat Purim, if one caused another person damage through the Purim rejoicing, meaning I was dancing around and waving my arms and I punched someone in the face, or so it seems, pater mila shalem, you're exempt from having to pay. So normally what happens is if you punch someone in the face, you have to pay the money. What happens here? You don't have to pay the money. Why? It's Purim. Okay, let's see if this thread continues. And in fact, you look at the very next siman in Shulchan Aruch and says the Ramah there as well. Mashe nahagu lilbosh partufim bifurim, this that they have the custom to wear, partufim literally means faces. Presumably it was some sort of mask that they used to wear, although it's clear from a number of different contexts that sometimes it refers to costumes as well. So partufim will translate as masks, but bear in mind that this also relates to costumes. And he says, there is some custom to wear these masks on Purim. V'gever lovesh simlat isha, v'isha klei gever. And a woman and a man wears women's clothing, and a woman wears men's clothing. Ein isur badavar. There's nothing wrong with that. There's no prohibition there. Me'achar, since she'ein mitkavnim ela l'simcha be'alma, because they are only intending to rejoice. They're doing it for fun, as we would say, right? It's like when you see two kids punching each other, and you say, "What's going on?" We're play fighting, right? So says the Ramah, we're play cross dressing. We're play wearing partufim on Purim. Right? Ela l'simcha be'alma. All we're doing is just for fun. It's just for the sake of rejoicing. V'chein b'levishat kilayim d'rabban. And then the Ramah says something even more curious. It wasn't enough just to tell us that cross-dressing was okay and wearing masks, which there, as we'll, I mean, we won't talk about this tonight, but there may be issues just with dressing up in general. There may be non-Jewish customs that this was taken from, but we won't go there tonight. And he continues, not only is it permitted to do that, but you can even wear a type of shatnez, kilayim d'rabbanan, any type of shatnez that is prohibited only from the rabbis, meaning it's not the shatnez that's prohibited by the Torah. And how to define that exactly is very complicated. It has to do with the understanding of the word sha'atnez, which is split up by Chazal into three different words, shu'a, tavoy, and nuz. The definition of each of those is a further machlokes, but basically, kilayim de'oraita, maybe either you need one of those three ingredients, maybe just spun, maybe just flattened out, maybe just woven together, and some people say you need all three of whatever shua, tavoy, and nuz are. And again, we're not here to tell you this halacha, but the point is the Ramah says, So long as it's Darabanan, if it's Chutneys, you can wear it on Purim. We'll talk a little bit more about this afterwards. V'yesh omrim de'asur, and some people say that all this is prohibited. Says the Ramah, though, aval hamina kisvara harishona. But our custom is to follow the first opinion, which is that it's permitted. And if it wasn't enough for you, the Ramah then goes way further. And he says, v'chein b'nei adam ha'chotfim zeh mizeh derech simcha. So too people who snatch things from each other. So I decide I like your purse on Purim. I steal your purse. Says the Ramah, ein bazeh mishum lo tigzol. There's no prohibition of not stealing. So we've gotten rid of shatnez, at least the Rabbana. We've gotten rid of cross-dressing, which is a clear iser d'oraisa. We've gotten rid of damaging people, which is, you know, certainly d'oraisa, in terms of having to pay for it, that we see from many places. And now we've just thrown out stealing, right? V'nahagu kach, and this is, again, what the custom is. Uvilvad shelo yaaseh davar shelo kehugan al pi tovei ha'ir. So long as people don't act inappropriately, and that's something which is judged by sort of the courts of the city, the governing body of the city. They had certain monetary rule, as you see in Choshen Mishpat and elsewhere, that they could say, you know, okay, ad kan, and enforce certain monetary laws beyond what halacha says. You say, I saw some blank stares. Is it just because the Ramah is so weird, or did you have a particular question?
I have a question.
Sure.
These are obviously in the context of Purim, and they specify Purim here, mm-hmm. but the first source identifies Mikoch Simchas Purim.
Mm-hmm.
The second source just identifies El Simcha Be'alma. It's in the context of Purim, but is there any room to say that this power of Simcha extends to other Simcha Lashma?
Absolutely. We're going to talk about other cases where these may be permitted based on similar logic. However, right now, what we see is, we see the Simchas Purim here, and we see that it's certainly talking about that there seems to be some sort of blanket allowance to just do all these different averos on Purim, because, oh, it's for fun. Yes?
Can you elaborate on the Tuvi Ha'ir? Like, who would that be in the practical context? Like,
because in the practical context,
these things would be something that they would just ban. You know, like, who decides this, that part of stuff? Who are those people?
So, I mean, now it would probably be the law.
Okay, so you're talking about,
practically speaking,
the 30s. You're talking about legal, like the Canadian or the Toronto police, for example.
I would assume that that's what it would be
okay.
Nowadays, yes.
Okay, fine.
We're talking about beyond technical Torah law, right?
Right.
Torah law, we're saying, permits this.
Right.
That's a Ramah's conclusion.
So
he's saying
stealing would not be permitted then in Toronto, but the cross-dressing perhaps would be.
Well, I mean, I'm not going so far as halacha lemaisa here. As we'll see, none of these are completely debate-free. So let's take a look, though. First, I wanted to go back one step. The Ramah cites as his source a tshuva from the Maharim Mint, which is looked at as the sort of central tshuva in this discussion, the central responsum in this discussion. And in it, he details why he thinks it's permitted. Now, he spends a lot of time, and we'll read through either the Hebrew or the English. Let's read through the English. It was a translation actually done by Rabbi Josh Gutenberg, who was formerly in our Beit Midrash, and he actually did that as a Toronto Torah translation one year. I happened to stumble upon it, completely unrelated to my researching for this year. I said, let me grab his translation off it. So let's read his translation. So the question is, regarding wearing costumes that young men and ladies, old men and children, which comes from Tehillim, of course, right, Bachurim v'gam betulot zekinim ne'arim, are accustomed to wear on Purim. Says, what's up with that? And he talks about how it's the minhag that everybody allows this, and everybody allows men to dress like women and women to dress like men. And there's no question that it's allowed, and other people much greater than him have, you know, stood by idly. And he says, but I've come to claim small reward like a splinter from a board. That's some of these weird phrases that you see. Of the commandment to provide a reason and bring proof for what they saw fit to do concerning the matter. The great and pious ones, among whom I grew up, who saw their sons and daughters, sons-in-law and daughters-in-law, wearing costumes and changing their dress from male clothing to female clothing and vice versa. If God forbid, says Rabbi Judah Mintz, their actions constituted even a hint of sin, it would have been a disgrace for them to remain silent and not protest their behavior. And how much more so if they were violating a prohibition? He says, look at all the great rabbis around who are watching people every Purim cross-dress and do some of these other things. Obviously, there's nothing wrong. These great rabbis would certainly have said something. Rather, certainly they had proof and a basis that it is completely permissible, and wearing this clothing incorporates not even a thought of sin. Okay, and he goes on to say that other people, again, have actually brought different proofs, and he himself will try to add on to those proofs. And here he writes, it is further found in a response written by Rabbeinu Tuvia, quoting Riva, okay, this is something that's going to come up, that any food that the young men grab in celebration of Purim, even without permission, okay, so we're talking food here, but let's keep this in mind, says even without permission, from the time of Megillah reading until the end of Purim Seuda, a period of 2 nights and 1 day, is not considered theft, and they cannot be summoned to court for this matter, provided they do not act inappropriately as determined by the communal leaders. Okay, so this is basically what the Rama was quoting. He was quoting this passage here, and he says, there's a blanket permission given from the beginning of Megillah reading until the end of the Purim Seuda that if you take food from someone else, then that's okay. They can't take you to court over it. I mean, we're clearly talking about enough of a case that they'd be interested in taking you to court, right? I mean, he's not saying that for fun. So this is quite astounding what he's saying, but he says this is the common practice. And this is what an earlier tshuva wrote. Behold, Rabbeinu Tuvia wrote that in the aforementioned time, it is not considered theft. But before Megillah reading and after the Purim Seuda, it is considered theft. And one violates the prohibition of do not steal. Nevertheless, tells us the Mahari Mitzvah, in the allotted time, due to the celebration of Purim, it's not considered theft, since he is not doing it for the purpose of stealing or profiting, but to celebrate Purim. So to in our scenario, cross-dressing on Purim, it is no different, since he does not intend to commit adultery, but rather he intends to celebrate Purim. The same way they did not define a limit regarding theft, since it is only practiced for 2 nights and 1 day, so to here, since theft and adultery stem from the same inclination, just as theft is permissible based on what the Riva writes in his responsum, so too cross-dressing is permissible. Both are things that people have a Yetzer Hara to do, and he says it's like the same Yetzer Hara, just like you can steal on Purim, so too you can cross-dress on Purim, provided obviously you're not having any really bad intentions, right? He says since he does not intend to commit adultery. We're not talking about someone who's using Purim as an excuse. He says, great, I'm going to break into the bank today because it's Purim. That's not what we're talking about, obviously. And so too, we're not talking about someone who is cross-dressing for the sake of cross-dressing and is just using Purim as an excuse. Rather, we're talking about people who are doing this as part of the spirit of the holiday. So I see you when I snatch something from you. And that's what the Mahari Mint is talking about, and this is what the Rama is basing himself on.
So, yeah, right. So that's what I was going to ask. It all seems to be about the Simcha of Purim, right? So okay, I'm going to steal your engagement ring because it's Purim. Like, no, because you're stealing a diamond ring that you have no intention, unless you're going to give it back after Purim, I suppose. But right. You're not going to go break into the bank because it's Purim.
Right.
So, like, do they talk later on about...
So that's basically what we're going to try to do today, is see where and when and how and why these different permissions may have been given and what they would extend to. That's basically the bulk of the shiur. This is sort of the introduction to say that right now, based on what we know, it just looks like Purim is a day of free-for-all. And I get why someone would get that impression based on reading these sources and others. So I think that's fair to say for now. So this is what I called, right, special allowances. We've seen that it's permitted, so to say, to damage other people in the course of Purim. It's permitted to cross-dress. It's permitted to wear certain types of shatnez. And it's permitted to steal, all within Purim. Now we get to the party poopers.
It's interesting you didn't include getting drunk.
Getting drunk was our classic example, yeah. And we're actually going to address it.
Yeah.
But it has a bit of a different take than everything else, for the first and most obvious reason that it's recommended. None of these are per se recommended. Okay. Perhaps maybe dressing up, maybe, but...
Some would say, the Rambam would say.
And again, we'll talk about whether or not, a little bit, whether or not there's actually a Chiyuv. The Rama, by the way, who we're quoting here, is of the opinion that it's best to just go to sleep after you drink a little bit more than usual. Of course, if you're used to drinking, 12 shots a day, then you may be in trouble anyways. Okay, says the Mishnah Berura, he summarizes some of the opposing opinions here that say that it's really not a good idea to follow what the Rama has suggested. The Rama himself, as we said, brought two opinions, and he said the custom clearly follows the first opinion, which is permissive. Okay, so on that, Harishona, meaning that where the Rama says that the custom follows the first opinion, Ayin b'yoradei asimen kuf bebet, shekatav sham hataz b'shem habach, sheyesh levatel min hagzeh. Where there, Okay, so Siman Kuf Pei Beis, Yoredeya Kuf Pei Beis, is about cross-dressing. It's all of the things that men shouldn't do because women do them, and all the things that women shouldn't do because men do them. We go through that, and there the Taz writes, in the name of the Bach, who is his father-in-law, and we'll actually see this Taz right at the end, She'esh levatel min hagzeh hein bipurim o besimchat nisuin. He says, you got to stop people from doing this. People right now are dressing up as members of the other gender. That is not appropriate. It's not appropriate on Purim, and it's not appropriate, says the Taz, when else do people do this? At weddings, they try to, you know, cheer up the bride and groom. It's a big mitzvah to do that. So, you know, a girl will dress up as a boy, a boy will dress up as a girl. And says the Taz in the name of the Bach, that's a very bad idea. V'chach kasa v'er ha-gola, and so writes the Be'er ha-gola sham. V'im kol ha-malbushim shel ish, rak malbush achat shel isha, v'nikarim him, says, if, however, everything the person is wearing is of the appropriate gender, except for one clothing item, efshar she'ein limchot bahem, says Mishbura, it's possible that you shouldn't protest to them. So this is the pretty high bar he's setting. We've gone from it's totally permissible and no question about it to dress up as a member of the other gender, to now it's possible if there's only one piece of clothing that fits that description that you shouldn't protest. Certainly, though, nothing's permitted, according to him, and this is quoting the Prima Gadim. And see the Knesset Agdola and Shala, who warned people to distance themselves from behavior such as this, like cross-dressing on Purim, cross-dressing at weddings. So Mishnah Berurah is not very happy, but he continues. It wasn't enough to address the cross-dressing. Mishum lo tigzol, in the next Mishnah Berurah, ulefiza, and according to this, mutar livarech al mashechotfim, says, if there's no prohibition of stealing, and this is halachically allowed on Purim, then you can even make a bracha on that. Normally, if you were to steal something, you shouldn't make a bracha on it, says the Mishnah Berurah. But here, since it's not really stealing, so if you got a Mishloach Manos from someone, I decide I want your bottle of wine because I want some more wine. So I grab your bottle of wine, I make my Bar Priya Geffen, and I down it. Not that I'll be doing that on Purim, again, disclaimer. But so that's what's going to come out according to the Rama. However, says the Mishnah Berurah, Mihu, right? They always say it's the big but. Katav Vishalah. The Shala writes, Lav Mishnat Chasidim hi. This is not the way that pious people act. Vishomer nafsho yirchak mimal bushim dekilayim velachtof mechaviro. And just as we said before, someone should distance themselves from cross-dressing in these scenarios, so too someone who really cares about their nefesh, someone who's very careful, should make sure to distance themselves from any issue of sha'atniz, malbushim dekilayim, and number two, lachtof mechavero, and this is cited from the Elia Rabbah. So you see the Mishnah Berurah is very opposed to what the Rama has to say. He's clearly saying that which opinion should we follow? The second opinion that prohibits this. The question is, he's not really clear as to why. He says these are bad things, and it could be that he disagrees with the Rama's reasoning, which we'll see later. But I actually saw sort of three distinct reasons why people disagree with the Rama. So here they are. One, which I just wanted to quote this because of the language used in it, is something cited from one place to another place to another place to another place. It was originally apparently said by the Rambam, which was cited in Sefer Maaser Rokeach, which was cited by the Birkei Yosef, which is cited by Rav Ben Tzion Abba Shaul in this response of his. And he says in source number 5, Ulam, b'Birkei Yosef Sham Ot Yud Gimel, in Birkei Yosef there, letter 13, Hevi divrei haRambam. He brought the words of the Rambam shehuvu barosh sefer maaser rokeach, which were brought in the introduction to sefer maaser rokeach from a responsum of the Rambam sheasar kein lechatan vekala, who prohibited damaging in the cases of weddings. Vekatav shelo yaale al hadat shemipnei heyotam chatan vekala hutar lahem yisur Torah. Right. As he says, nobody would ever think that just because they're getting married, so they don't have to work, keep the laws of the Torah, so too, we could say here, no, it would never occur to anybody to say that just because it's Purim, there's no Isser to do all these things. They're still written in the Torah, Lo Yulbash Geresim Lasisha. It's still written in the Torah, Lo Tigzol. So therefore, it's not a question. According to the Rambam, and as we'll see, a number of others, it's just simply not true. There's no reason to permit this. And if people are doing that, they are in the wrong and they must be corrected. However, there are other ways to deal with it. The Aruch HaShulchan, interestingly, in Aruch Chaim here in number 12, who's normally a very, very big minhag person, who's very focused on upkeep of the customs of Bnei Yisrael. Umash in Hagu in source number 6, Biyamim Kadmonim Bilvishat Partufim Mishatnez, And this that they had the custom to wear, again, masks or costumes that were made out of shatnez, vishel ish leisha, and that men would wear women's clothing and vice versa. Achshav lo nahagu kein, now they no longer practice this. Vichein mish mishehizik, and so too someone who damaged someone else, chayav lishalem, they would be obligated to pay. De'ataba avonotenu harabim, that now, and due to our great sins, arva kol simcha v'ein anu b'madrigazu, says we're not on this level anymore. Now we have lost all feelings of simcha, which comes from a pasuk in Yeshaya. It's darkened from the lashon of erev, arva kol simcha. It's sort of set. And therefore, he says, even though in the times of the Ramah they could do it, we can't do it because we don't have the proper rejoicing anymore. And as he says, Umasha katav Ramah v'sifchet, hulekayim mashenagu b'yamav v'lo achshav. He says he was simply defending the practice of then, but we no longer have this practice. There's no need to defend this, and we don't have the true simcha that would be an excuse for someone to do something like this. That's the way he phrases it. I'm going to go yes, and then you.
I'm just confused in the sense that, first of all, Yeshaya, that quote is a pasuk from a long time, way before both societies ever existed. So if he's going to say, choose, use that as the pasuk to say that this, yes, this time around, we don't have the same joy, what is the type of joy that they had at the time of the Ramah that we don't have today?
So I think he would say that it is a type of joy that was gone long ago, and that's his response to the Ramah, is saying that the Ramah had this practice to deal with. Meaning, in theory, once upon a time, people could have been at the level where, yes, there was no Arva Kol Simcha, there's a Beis HaMikdash, everybody's happy, and as we're going to see, this actually has its roots in the Simchat Beit HaShoeva, in the Beit HaMikdash. So he says that is a theoretical Simcha that's possible. Based on that, if we have a custom that we have to defend, then we have to defend it. But if we no longer have a custom that we have to defend, because no one's doing this, so why tell people, you know, go and announce in the streets, you're not doing any averos, go, let's announce, do averos.
So the response would be different if people were doing it.
That's what I see in his words. You can reread it for me, but that's the way I'm understanding him, and I'm certainly open to other options. And you were going to comment? That was your question. Okay, perfect. Yes, the Aruch HaShulchan actually likes using that phrase. I've seen it, I think, in a couple of other places, although I'll have to check that up exactly where. I believe he says it regarding maybe Sheva Bracha? I don't know. Anyways, that's Aruch HaShulchan's take on things. There are other people that may, in theory, agree, but they actually think this is not a good idea for practice. And that's this last sort of set of people here. It's both the Olat Shabbat here and the Taz in Yoredeya in the Halachot of cross-dressing. Says the Olat Shabbat, v'chein nachon limchot bahem, it is appropriate to protest against people that are doing this. Ki ein midaktikim ben kilayim de'oraita lidrabanan. He says, meaning, there are certain limits that we give. We say we're willing to allow you to wear a certain type of shatnez, which is kilayim de'rabanan. What happens is, though, people say, yep, everything's allowed on Purim, so they start going beyond that. So he says, it could be that in truth the Ramah is correct. In theory, if we were to follow the Ramah to the letter of the law, it would be okay. But that's not what's happening down there on the ground. People are wearing shatnez d'oraita. Why? Because de lav kulei alma dina gemiri. Not everybody's so learned. Not everybody knows the law exactly. So they think shatnez d'rabanan is up till here, and really it's not. They've been wearing shatnez d'oraita, which even according to the Ramah is prohibited. So he says having these rules is not practical. And so too, if you look at the Taz in Yoredeya, he says, "Ki yesh harbe michsholot chas v'shalom mizeh kesholchin biyachad b'li heker isho isha." He says, you can imagine the issues here. What happens is, everybody's on the street, they're wearing their giant monster costumes. You don't know if it's a boy, a girl, a monkey, right? You don't know what's under that costume, right? Or a man is dressed as a woman, you don't know if it's a man or a woman anymore. He says, this is just not a good idea. Practically speaking, you don't want this to be happening on Purim for a whole host of reasons that I'm sure many of you can imagine. Halachic reasons and other practical reasons for just running society properly, avoiding all sorts of sins and bad circumstances. So these people might technically agree to the rule of the Ramah, but still want to prohibit these practices from this alternate practical point of view. So these, I think, were sort of three almost distinct ways of looking at it. One, which is that it's just completely halachically prohibited. Two, we're not on their level. And maybe for a mitos thing, which is, you saw that a little bit in the Mishnah Berurah, but finally, because of other concerns, it would be prohibited. So that's so far what we've got here. So we have, to summarize, the Rama brings a whole host of things that are allowed on Purim, even though they don't seem to make sense. And now we've got a bunch of people pushing back and saying that's wrong for this reason, or that's practically incorrect, or that's not a good idea. So far so good? Okay. Now we take a short break to talk about drinking on Purim. And here I thought I'd just bring one bir halacha just to touch on it, not to ignore it, because drinking is possibly the worst thing of all of these things that we listed. I'm going to leave that up in the air. Drinking has a lot of bad press in halacha. It's not a good thing. And the Mishnah Berurah puts it perfectly. In source number 9, in the Bir Halacha, here he writes, Chai v'nish l'besumi b'puraya, which is the quote from Shulchan Aruch, which says that a person is obligated to drink on Purim till they don't know the difference between Arur Haman and Baruch Mordechai. And says the Bir Halacha on that, Vim Tomar, Heich kichayevu chazal mashenizkar b'torah uvinviyim b'kama mekomot hashikrut l'michshal gadol. Says, how could the rabbis possibly tell us that there's a mitzvah to go and get smashed? Did you not read all of Tanakh? Or any of Tanakh, for that matter? Didn't you read Sefer Bereishit? You didn't get enough stories in Sefer Bereishit from people getting drunk and getting into trouble? Why on earth would Chazal choose to make this a mitzvah? Right? And not only that, it's just mind-boggling to him. He says, V'yesh lamar, says we have to say, the answer is, M'pnei shekol anisim shenasu liYisrael b'mei HaChashverosh, hayu al yedei mishteh. Everything that happened in the Purim story happened through some sort of drinking party. Okay, mishteh doesn't mean a banquet and a feast, it means a drinking party. Right, like lishtot. Ki b'tchila nitrida Vashti al yedei mishteh, right, the first story with Vashti, Vashti's downfall happens during the great banquet. Uva'a Esther, and through that Esther comes in, v'chein inyan Haman u'mapalato haya al yedei mishteh, right, Esther invites Achashverosh and Haman to her little parties, and so that's how Haman ends up, again, having his downfall. V'lachein chiyivu chachamim lihishtaker ad kedei sheyehen nizkar hanes hagadol b'shtiyat hayayin. The purpose of this is simply to remember the great miracle that happened through shtiyat hayayin. That's how he seems to be interpreting Bein Arur Haman LeBaruch Mordechai, meaning remember the miracle that happened. And this is one of the lines that, this next line is something I don't think you'll see anywhere else in the Torah. You have chayev inish lebesume, right? Chayev to do something. You're obligated to do something. Reminds us, the Mishnah Berurah reminds us. He says, Mikol makom, kol zeh lemitzvah v'lo le'akev. Just remember, it's only a mitzvah. Okay, it's only a mitzvah, guys. Don't think that you have to do it. It's not really a chiyuv, even though it says chayev inish lebesume. Just remember, it's only a mitzvah. Okay, so that's it's a type of comment that speaks volumes about what has been said and what has not been said. In terms of, obviously, the practical guidelines, you know, ask your rabbi what he thinks, especially when we're in a shul with a rav. It is interesting to see that the way he deals with this, he says, yes, there is some sort of conflict where we see on Purim, we would think that there would be greater guidelines and greater permission to do something that's not allowed to be done. He says, no, we need to give a local reason as to why this behavior is permitted when it doesn't make sense to permit it. So that's our little sort of break for drinking on Purim. Now we can get back to the discussion of the sources. And what I'd like to basically present is we're going to go mainly through the damaging and stealing parts. And we're going to spend a little bit of time as well on the shatnez and cross-dressing to see whether or not this is something that is uniquely permissible on Purim because the day is Purim, or why it may be permissible on Purim. And that can be done by going back to some of the reasons and sources as to why this is permitted. So some of those sources will be local to what we're talking about here. Some of those can be found, the reasons can be found in the response of the Maori Mints that we saw in source number 3. Some of them can be seen in the Rama's other writings here, and especially in his Darkei Moshe, which we'll quote a couple of times. But some go back even further. So we mentioned other joyous times. We mentioned Arva Kol Simchan. We mentioned the Beit HaMikdash. If you look in source number 10, it quotes us a Mishnah from Sukkah. The Mishnah in Sukkah tells us, and we'll read the English translation here, the Jews would bring date palm branches and lay them down on the ground alongside the altar. That day was called the day of the laying down of the branches. So far, so good. Okay, we're talking about the end of Sukkot. And then, says the Mishnah, and we're going to read the English translation at this time, they would then snatch the lulavim from the hands of the children and eat their etrogim. So we have people taking things. So you've got your kid. You can imagine a little kid. You know, the little kids are always very proud of, you know, their lulav and esrog when they get it for the first time. So the little kid sitting there holding his lulav and his esrog, and an adult comes over, snatches his esrog, takes a bite out of it, and gives it back. First of all, yeah, a little creepy. But anyways, and the Hebrew wording for this, though, is interesting. Miyad tinokot shomtin et lula vehen veochlin etrogehen. The wording is miyad. Now, miyad is interpreted, as we see, as from the hand. And that's exactly the way Tosfot quote Rashi, and Rashi himself there says it. What does miyad mean? Miyad can mean one of two things. If you were to translate it, our local resident Israeli, how would you translate miyad?
Immediately.
Either immediately or from the hand. So the question is, which one is correct here? If it means immediately, is anybody doing any stealing? Not at all. It just means immediately they would take them and they would eat their etrogs. But if it means from the hands, then it means they were stealing. And Tosfot says this, right? Miyad tinokot shomtin lulavehen, lulavei hatinokot shomtin hagdolim miyadan veochlin etrogehen shel tinokot. He says, very simple. As we said, the adults come and they steal the lulav and etrog from the little kids and they eat them. Ve'ein bidavar gezel. Says Tosfot, but don't worry about it. You might think that this is prohibited because you're stealing. You're literally taking what is someone else's and you're eating it. You're damaging it irreparably. It is that funny, I know. Velomishum derkei shalom. There's not even anything problematic about this, about the ways of peace, which would be something above and beyond stealing. Ela shekach nahagu bo machmat simcha. Rather, this is the customary way of merrymaking. This is the way that people had fun. You'd snatch someone else's stuff. And it doesn't mean literally every adult would go over to every kid, but people would just steal stuff from each other, mess with it. You know, there'd be a shtickle lulav and estrog fight. I used to read a comic book, a Hebrew comic book called Bava. Anybody familiar with it? It's an Israeli... So Shai Chirko, who's the illustrator of it, he puts all these different mishnayos in comic book form. And the main character is a character named Bava, of course. Bava Matia, Bava Vastra, Bava Kama. And that's sort of like a little running joke. And I remember this Mishnah. And, you know, it was this one or maybe it was another one earlier in Sukkah. And, like, the illustrations of all these different things, you know, people having, like, sword fights with their lulavim. Like, these were the types of things that people would do. They'd have fun. And therefore, say to us, well, this is what was going on. People were stealing things from one another. People were snatching things. And it's all fine because you're only intending to have fun. And therefore, Kach Birsh Bekuntres is the way Rashi explains it. Ve'yesh l'mod mikan. And here is the takeaway. This is the takeaway. V'yesh l'mod mikan le'otan bachurim she'rochvim b'susim likrat chatan. For those young men who ride on horses, and they would have little jousting matches in front of a chatan and kala, this was their wedding shtick, right? There's Purim shtick, there's wedding shtick, and the wedding shtick in the time of Tosfot was, people would come in on horses, and v'nilchamim ze'im ze'v, v'korin b'gdo shel chaviro. So you can imagine they're actually jousting, and they're jousting with real swords. And what happens every once in a while, you know, the person's armor gets nicked, and they tear their shirt, or accidentally you jab the horse in the leg, the horse goes, and falls down, right? It wasn't always pretty, and says Tosfot, you know what, you don't have to worry about damages in those cases, because it's all done for the sake of happiness. Just like in this Mishnah, we see it's okay, no one minds. So too there, that's completely permitted, right? Shehen piturin, these people are exempt from liability. Shekach nahagu machmat simchat chatan vekala. That's the way you cheer up these people, you add to the simcha, you add to the celebration, you add to the joy. Therefore, it's totally fine. So we see this is not something that's local to Purim. This is something that's learned out originally from, a celebration of Sukkot. And applies even to just regular weddings where a certain exemption from liability is present because it's done for happiness. Now, at this point, we've got to figure out a couple of things. Number one, what does it mean? Because it's done for happiness, it's allowed. Whoever heard of such a halachic term, it's done for happiness? What is the actual mechanism halachically by which this is appropriate? And then we can see if that applies today. Number one. Number two, how far does this go? Let's say someone was, you know, jousting in front of the... Chatan al-Kala and accidentally stabs the other guy in the heart and he dies. Does it go that far? So we have to see sort of how this works and how far this goes.
It's like there's by entering into the jousting match in front of the Chatan al-Kala, you're accepting that perhaps you'll have some damage inflicted upon you, but the question is how much, perhaps.
Okay, yeah, I think that's very fair. I mean, I'm not sure if you could apply that same logic to coming to the Beis HaMikdash on Sukkos.
Right.
Perhaps. I mean, if you know that it's going to happen, you could make that argument. I'm not sure, though. Any other thoughts?
A lot more free-spirited than we were. Like, we're, like, debating every nuance of it, and then they just kind of... They were a little bit wild. They were a little bit wild. The fact that they're even discussing this is so interesting to me, that they would have such loose inhibitions.
I mean, this is... Make no mistake about it. This is something that was going on regardless of whether or not the rabbis may have necessarily wanted it. As we see, the Rambam is very opposed to this, as we cited earlier. Tosfot saying, listen, this is why people are okay. They don't have to pay each other back if they, again, you know, jab the horse in the leg, because, you know, everybody's just happy about it. But people do, as we are about to do, try to figure out exactly why this is allowed, and if it is allowed, and how long it'll be allowed, and how expansive such a heter will be.
I was wondering, maybe because everybody's so happy, you may not be, like, exempt, but no one's going to really care. So
That's a very important point. I would keep that in mind as we read through the next sources.
You shouldn't care. Well, just everyone's so happy, so I hurt your horse. It's not that I'm not, like, exempt, but you're not going to care because you're so happy you're in a wedding.
It's saying the law. It's saying that if you do care, don't care. Or if you do care,
it could be. I mean, let's think back again to what the Mari Mint said, right? Where on the first page we mentioned that he's like, you can't take someone to Beis Din over this.
Right.
If you walk into Beis Din, they'll throw you out.
Wait, the assumption so is that something to keep try it. Try to bring you to Beis Din over it.
Right. So perhaps, again, that's a statement about where people's minds should be. But the fact on the ground there, that there is a technical halachic exemption here that is actually enforceable in court. Right. So we have to try to figure out what that may be.
Is there any commentary related to this? I'm forgetting exactly who the players were, but the Purim Suda or somebody kills somebody else.
Rabbi Rabzira?
Yes.
It's not related to this.
Is that a little
it's
bit
It's not related to this. That's, I think, beyond the realm of...
I can't imagine murder would be...
Yeah. There's a lot to talk about. I actually saw something fascinating on that, but let's stick to our topic for now. This will be a long discussion, I think. The first... Really, two approaches are seen actually in the Darkei Moshe himself over here. But Tshuvat Riva, and he quotes that same Tshuvat Riva that the Mahari Mint quoted in number 3. He says, excuse me, Shekatav, Deleka Lamechash Leisur Gezel Mishum Simcha. And he's explaining over here why it's different than wearing Kilayim. He's saying Kilayim may be more. There's more of a reason to prohibit people wearing shatnez than actually, again, worrying about stealing. And here's what he says. Why? Dimamon nitan limchila, dehefker betin hefker, masha'en kin be'isur. He quotes two reasons which are sort of one. When it comes to just having fun with people, if you get a mishloach manos from someone and I steal a beastly from you, do you really care? Some people might, okay? No offense to you if you do care, but I wouldn't care. And that's part of the first part of it, is that there is some element where there is a certain assumed mechila, meaning it's Purim, we know everybody's running around, and you're supposed to be giving people money, and someone comes by, they snatch something from you, and so long as it's done in good happiness, there's a certain assumed mechila, as we said, that we're understanding that, you know, you certainly can be mochel such a thing, and maybe you should even be mochel such a thing. We'll see this a little bit in more detail later. But he also invokes the important rule of Hefker, Beitin, Hefker. Anybody familiar with that rule from before?
Sounds like the Beis Din dismisses something.
So there is a rule that, yes, Beis Din can dismiss monetary suits because they have the right, so to say, to make all your possessions ownerless. Meaning they have certain monetary rights where they can decide whose is what based on their power. It's used in, you know, not so many different cases. It's not something we like to talk about. It actually comes up, we're learning Kiddushin this year at the Kollel, so it comes up a little bit with, perhaps with Hafkat Kiddushin, maybe with the money that was given by the man to the woman who he's trying to marry. It comes up in a few different places, but the gist of it is, Beis Din has the right to decide your money's final destination, so to say. And here they can say, listen, you know, this is something that if you're coming to court over something like this, really, like, just get out of here. The money that he should have paid you, now it's back to him, and, you know, we fixed everything up. And we wrapped it up like that, but it's based on, as you can see, this idea of mechila, that there's certain assumed, you know, forgiveness for things like this that happen. Now, what's very interesting to note is how far might mechila go? Mechila might go for something very little, But how far does it extend? And I want you all to look back now, and I'll give you just a couple of minutes to look through it and see if you can glean any interesting ideas from the two examples that Tosfot gave. Tosfot, right, gave two examples at the wedding, two types of damages that he said are fine, but he didn't mention other things. Any ideas?
Not sure. Something about minors, potentially, like it was stealing from a minor.
Okay, so there is...
And then also not damaging each other, they're damaging...
Excellent. That's the one I was looking for.
Okay.
And that's the one that I believe the Magen Avraham picks up on. Actually, the Knesset HaGedolah picks up on it, and the Magen Avraham quotes him. Minors is a separate issue. There are people that are willing to be more permissible, actually, lahalacha, about, for example, allowing a minor to dress up, you know, in a costume that looks like the opposite gender, or maybe even with kilayim, although we're not going to get there so much. I wanted to focus more on the second thing you said, which is Tosfot gives two examples. Example number one, tearing the other guy's clothing. Example number two, injuring his horse. What's missing? You got a scratch on your shoulder. I mean, again, we're not talking about murdering someone. We're talking about, you know, scratch, a nick, whatever it is. And says the Magen Avraham, Uvekneset HaGdolah Katav, in source number 13, Davka Shehizik Mamono. It's only where he caused monetary damage that on Purim you don't have to pay for it. But says Magen Avraham, again, quoting Knesset HaGdolah, Aval Gufo Chayav. If you, for fun, accidentally hit someone in the face, or if you were rejoicing in some way and, again, something else happened to someone else's body, that is no longer in the realm of allowed Purim damage, and that Purim damage you're actually liable for, you have to pay the person back for damage. You broke someone's arm by mistake, you can't just get away with this Purim excuse anymore. That's going to be prohibited. And that's sort of the way that's the way the Knesset HaGedolah feels. However, my guess is that it's perhaps based on these two examples that were given. However, he tells us something else, and this is even more of a historical curiosity for people that are interested in that side of things. Aval ba'aguda sukkah katav, if you look up a Sefer Aguda on Masechet Sukkah here, he writes, Keshem misachkim abachurim b'shabbat. He writes, they used to go out, and I saw the full Aguda inside, where he adds a few words here. He says, they used to go out to these courtyards on Shabbos, and they used to play fight. Keshem misachkim abachurim b'shabbat, umakin zeh zeh, pturim. He says, I rely on this Tosfot to say that it's okay, even though someone punched the other guy in the face, and he, you know, knocked out a tooth. Too bad. Off the hook. Why? Because even when it comes to physical damage, this waiver of having fun and playing applies. And this was their Shabbos activity. That's what's so mind-boggling here.
Is it Shabbos that it's...
No.
It's
no.
Just in general. People
no.
Are
that's why they did it.
And they hurt each other?
That's what he seems to say. He says... So long as they do not intend to damage. Meaning, obviously, again, we're not talking about someone who just tries to beat someone up and hurt them. That is going to be something that is not allowed. But simply to just, you know, end up hitting someone by mistake or end up hurting someone by mistake, even we could say, that would be something that he says is permissible. And this is the final line in the Magen Avraham. Now, we still haven't answered in the Magen Avraham's view as to why this is allowed. And the Machatzit HaShekel picks up on something within the Magen Avraham, which is that last line from the Aguda, Uvilvad Shelo Yitkavnu, so long as they're not intending. Now, normally, in Hilchot Shabbat, in a lot of other halachot around what we call Kol HaTorah Kula, there is this concept called Davar She'ein Mitkavein. Anybody familiar with that? I see some nods. What's Davar She'ein Mitkavein? On Shabbos. So you can explain it to me on Shabbos.
Just if you do something and you didn't mean to do it, it's a different category of sin?
Yep. In fact, it's allowed.
Right.
It's allowed, so long as it's not guaranteed going to happen.
Right.
It's not necessarily a byproduct. That's fine. Let's say it's a byproduct. Okay? What happens is, again, you're doing something you don't intend to do that action. It turns out to be a malacha that's actually totally allowed on Shabbos, unless it's for sure going to happen by definition of you doing the first action, and then it gets a lot more complicated beyond that. And this even applies to other halachot as well. And my first guess would have sort of been to say that perhaps there's some sort of similar rule here. The problem is, almost every single case of damages, every single classic case of damages, is where you're not intending to do that. I mean, normally what happens is you trip over something and you break it. You're not intending on breaking it. I mean, that's what all the cases of Nizikin are. And in fact, there is obviously no such exemption of davar shein mitkaven for nezikin. You won't find it anywhere because it doesn't exist. There is no exemption. So we're left trying to rework these words into, again, some sort of halachic concept that we can say is the reason for why this would be permitted. And the Machzir HaShekel basically says, you know, he explains the Magen Avraham a little bit further. We're going to skip that. That's verse number 14. Let's jump to number 15. He gives Primagadim, which is a commentary on the Magen Avraham, or what we call a super commentary, which is a commentary on a commentary. He explains the Magen Avraham here. He says, Ein Magen Avraham, Hainu Shelo Bechavana. Right? He says, obviously, just to remind everybody that when the Magen Avraham quoted the Knesset HaGedola to say that if you damage someone's property, you are, again, off the hook on Purim, that's only if you did it unintentionally. He says, obviously, if you did it intentionally, aval bechavana, afizik mamanoch hayav, demayshna Purim, yishar yamim. He says, but if you did it on purpose, Purim is not a special heter for you to go around, you know, smashing people's windows. It's not Halloween. It's no trick-or-treats. It's only for accidental damage that came through merrymaking. And then he notes, v'shelo bechavana be'alma chiyuv. He says, normally, again, to do something not intentional on Purim, we would assume would be not allowed. Why? Because in general, if you do something unintentionally, I trip over something and break something, I'm responsible. Even if I'm sleeping and I damage something, I'm responsible. So normally, it is something that's not allowed. However, uvipurim mistama mochlin. He says this all depends on mechila. We can assume that if you accidentally do something in the course of Purim that's related to merrymaking, so okay, you can assume that the person is mochel. And this would apply, according to the Magen Avraham and according to the Aguda, whether or not it's physical damage, whether or not it's simply damage that comes to someone's possessions or otherwise. And this is the way that he looks at it. However, in the next line, Mikoach Simchat Purim, which is on still on this page in the Hebrew, right? It's on the last line of the English and on the last line of the Hebrew. It's still in source number 15. Mikoach Simchat Purim, what does it mean? Through, while rejoicing in the Purim rejoicing, in the Purim happiness. Hava ke'anus k'tzat. It's a little bit like you fall into the category of onus. Means it's unpreventable. Whether or not something unpreventable is actually exempt from damages is actually a huge machlokas. We're not going to get into that, but he gives us two possible reasons. Number one, an assumed mechila, which we saw earlier in the Darkei Moshe, and I think that's what makes the most sense to us, which it can be used in combination with Hefker, Bezdin, Hefker to say, we are setting a bar where we're assuming that people are mochel, whatever amount of damage, provided it's unintentional. Or he can say that perhaps it's like, I was just rejoicing, like I didn't do anything wrong. There is a certain level where he might even be called an anus, someone who, again, was sort of had no choice, and therefore he might be exempt for that reason, but I think the main reason that people give is the mechila reason. Yes?
So I get the unintended thing with, okay, I actually damaged your shirt, or I damaged your horse, and mm-hmm. we were both fighting, but I accidentally stole your etrog, took a bite, and gave it back to you. I couldn't guarantee that was going to happen when I stole the etrog, but sure enough, the etrog had now bitted. That's pretty intentional.
Well, imagine if it's almost like a custom. I mean, we have all sorts of weird customs in Judaism.
Okay, so that would be part of the group of, like, we're rejoicing, we're all taking etrogs.
Yeah,
and we're
it's our minhag to eat etrogs.
Right. I mean, the concept of ones in general is that something happens which is completely out of the ordinary, mm-hmm. that's unpreventable.
Mm-hmm.
But this other concept where you're pater, it's almost as if the other person is a willing participant, or you're engaging in some type of situation where there is the possibility that something like this will happen. Mm-hmm. So is that to say that engaging in the day of Purim, it just happens to be that because there is, I guess, either precedent or
drunkenness,
in the day,
people running around
right.
and
I mean,
trying
if you're,
to...
If you're a participant in an area of people celebrating Purim, if you're actively there, then...
Yeah, you're a willing participant.
You're a willing participant.
Yeah, and there's an assumption
there's
also,
no
again, it's
there,
something... Well, that's the question, is does this line apply only to monetary damage? Does this line apply to physical damage? That could be part of the sort of calculation,
right.
as to how far would people take this.
And it's not a specific form thing, meaning if you can extend it to...
Correct, you can extend it to weddings.
Any general environment.
Right. Correct.
Shabbos,
correct.
Horsing around.
Because it's not something special about Purim. There's no special heter for doing averos on Purim. It's simply that Purim is a circumstance under which there is an assumed mechila, and there is a ruling of hefker betin hefker, and there is, again, perhaps even an element of onus involved. And that, I think, is to say that there's nothing, again, inherently special about the day of Purim that things are allowed. But rather, it's a local din within the idea of stealing. It's a local din within the idea of damaging, to say that these are cases where monetarily it's not a concern. Not that there's anything special about the day of Purim itself.
But that's the day where these things typically come up.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. If you want a little summary here in source number 16, he goes through just a couple of ideas. For the sake of time, I'm just going to run through the last couple of sources, and then you can go back. But this is certainly something that you can take a look at afterwards. He goes through the different levels in his opinion as to what would be allowed, what would be not allowed. And the article itself is actually excellent. It also goes on to discuss non-physical damage, but emotional and verbal attacks that happen on Purim and are known to happen on Purim and what he thinks of those. But you can definitely look up that article. It's an excellent article. And Rav Rimon, of course, does not need anything from me to make him appreciate it. Let's jump to our last two cases. Wearing rabbinical shatnez on Purim. First of all, just a question. Why would anybody wear shatnez on Purim? Anybody think of any ideas? You are not allowed to answer this question.
Certain costumes that...
Does anybody know where in Tanakh, or better yet, where in the Torah and Megillas Esther, we have shatnez in a costume?
When Mordechai is dressed up to the horse, maybe?
Very good. Mordechai yatzam lifnei ha-melech, bilvush malchut techelet vachor, va'ater zav lila v'tachrich, and what was his wrapping? Boots, which is? Linen? Argaman is? Wool. Right? He was wrapped up in wool and linen. So that's one. That's a very good one. Any other major figure in Jewish history that wore something made out of wool and linen? Kohen Gadol, very good. And who do we know, according to the Medrash, dresses up as the Kohen Gadol? Achashverosh. Okay, so we're seeing a common theme. Shatnez itself is actually mentioned elsewhere in the Megillah as well.
Really far with your costume.
At the beginning.
Where the actual Bitigirna.
No, but sometimes you want it to make things look the same, and especially knowing the coloring and how the different fibers worked, especially in older days, it wasn't so easy to make, you know, a replica of any clothing made out of polyester and cotton. Those may not have been easily available. So that's definitely a possibility as to where this started coming up and to whether or not that might apply to Shatnez Doraisa, Derabanan, and that's a longer story, and I can refer to you to an excellent article on that. But let's try to finish up. So the Darkei Moshe, we'll read through the English here. However, after we see that this custom of wearing shatnez costumes has spread and no one protests, it seems to me to justify the custom based on what we say in the last chapter of Kilayim. This is source 17, Mishnah 9:2, and it is brought in chapter Hagozel Batra. That's not the name. It's the second Hagozel Perek. It's not if you steal a Batra, whatever that would mean. That's permitted to wear shatnez, ready for this one, to evade taxes. Note, this is in regard to the prohibition of shatnez. Does not relate to the general issues relating to tax evasion, okay? So, based on the circumstances of that Mishnah, basically, as Rama says, we see from this that when he is not intending to wear them, meaning as clothing, it's permitted. He's simply wearing them as a disguise or to not have to pay duty on them, whatever it is. And therefore, certainly according to the few commentaries that explain that he's wearing them in order that they should not recognize that he's Jewish, meaning this is actually a costume for him, according to some commentaries, in that Mishnah and Kilayim. So this, certainly, right, according to them, it's permitted. We can learn that when they are worn as a disguise, it is permitted, so too on Purim. Such seems to me the reason for this custom. The Ramah is not the only one to argue like this. I remember my Rebbe in Yeshiva, Rabbi Shurkin, pointing out a Meiri when we were learning Masechet Yevamot, which talks about the criteria of what is actually considered wearing for the purposes of shatnez. So, it actually may come out, by the way, if you're wearing something which is a Dirabanan type of shatnez, you may want to make sure that that's not really what you're wearing for that day, and it's only some sort of costume that you're wearing on top of your clothing, perhaps, because you may have more of an issue if you're wearing it as your clothing for the day, and you're not wearing anything underneath. So, just something to keep in mind. But this is the reason why the Ramah says that it's prohibited. Not anything special about Purim, because Mordechai wore shatnez, maybe, and because Achashverosh wore the big tekuna. It's nothing to do with that per se. Rather, it's something special within the rules of shatnez. Meaning, if this were to happen on any other day of the year, again, for the right reasons, that may also be permitted. Okay?
This is more of an aside, but would the same implications exist with tzitzis and a four-cornered garment?
As to allow shatnez, that's a separate
it as a costume. No, rather, if you're wearing a
to not have
costume,
to wear tzitzit, I didn't. So yeah, you'd have to go far into the definition of what's a baguette, but ostensibly, You could start to deal with something like this. I don't know of anybody that said that offhand, though. Okay. So yeah, I would suggest if you're actually wearing a four-cornered garment, you know, try to put on tzitzis on Purim. Can't be a bad thing. Finally, we get to cross-dressing. I'm just going to summarize this outside for time, but you're welcome to look through it. We go through the Taz. The Taz talks about a case where, according to the strict original halachot of Beged Isha, it was actually prohibited for men to use mirrors and to look in mirrors to beautify themselves. However, the general rules of Beged Isha and Beged Ish, or Kli Gever, are very, very, very malleable depending on what people do, as you see in the Shulchan Aruch in source 19, and as you'll even see in the Taz in source 18, that basically it depends on what everybody else does. If all the men are doing it, then it is something that men do. If none of the men are doing it, then it's not something that men do when it comes to, again, beautifying oneself in some way. It also seems that when there is no intention to do it for any, again, adorning or decorative fashion, but rather you're just dressing up as a costume, that would be another reason to permit it, but you can look through the Taz. The Bach argued and said that he brings from the Yireim, Rabbi Eliezer Mimitz, to say that even for a wedding, it's prohibited because it's all about just wearing the costumes, not about the intentions that you have, and not about the the relative community standards. But again, the community standards and the fact that you're not wearing it in order to disguise yourself as a member of the other gender, but rather celebrate Purim, are reason enough to permit it in a number of sources. And for that reason, also, the prohibition of cross-dressing is not something that's local to Purim, and it's not there's a blanket permission for you to do this on Purim, but again, this would apply to any cases of simcha or reason that you had where you could argue that, again, it's local to cross-dressing. So in summary, we have three/four major cases that the Rama says are okay to do on Purim, and it turns out that really all of them are local within the laws of that particular action, and that simply come to the fore on Purim where people tend to be doing these actions not for their Avera's sake, but for a happiness reason and in order to rejoice with other people. And again, in terms of practical halachot, it's for sure best to consult with a rabbi on these ones. As we saw, there are many people that don't like this idea. But again, you know, our goal is that, you know, whatever stand you tend to take, it should all be done for the sake of happiness, rejoicing, and have a happy, happy Purim. Thank you.